Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Alan Committee is one of South Africa's leading award-winning comic performers. He treads international waters regularly, including hosting a South African comedy festival at the Leicester Square Theatre from 2014 to 2017. He has performed in two London pantomimes, headlined at the Laugh Factory in Los Angeles, and performed on New York comedy stages. As a producer, director, writer, and performer, his first love has always been theatre, but he has worked extensively in television and radio too. Although he studied as an actor, he is best known for starring in and writing his 26 stand-up-based one-man shows over the last quarter of a century, including Fast and Reasonably Furious, Live and Let Laugh, Apocalypse Laughs Now, The Lion King, Planet Mirth, Love Factually, The Sound of Laughter, and numerous others. But Alan is remembered for his starring role in the long-running Broadway hit show Defending the Caveman, with over 974 performances across South Africa. In 2023, Alan Committee was inducted into the Comics Choice Awards Hall of Fame for his career in comedy. Straight theatre performances include the lead roles in Same Time Next Year, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Producers, Richard III, Aliana, Noises Off, The Merry Widow, Little Shop of Horrors, Amadeus, and many more. Alan has also directed numerous theatre projects, including The Outlaw Muckridge, Offbeat Broadway, The Play That Goes Wrong, The Comics Choice Awards, and Not the Midnight Mass, 21 years. He is considered one of South Africa's most skilled master of ceremonies and has hosted numerous Fleur de Cap Naledi and SAFTA award shows, as well as being the host of the Sunday Times Top 100 Company Awards dinner 6 years in a row. Television credits include a lead role in Recipes for Love and Murder, a recurring role in the sketch show Laugh Out Loud, showrunner, writer, and star of Van der Walt's Fault, and co-creator and writer of Those Who Can't. Alan received two Fleur de Cap Best Actor Awards for Richard III and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and two Naledi Theatre Awards for Best Comic Performance for Stress to Kill and Live and Let Laugh, respectively. He also has a South African Film and Television Award for Best Supporting Actor in Laugh Out Loud. Alan has appeared in numerous stand-up festivals, including hosting the Jive International Cape Town Funny Festival for 12 of the 16 years it has been presented. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Alan Committee. Where are you in the world and how are you doing?
Well, you find me in the heart of Joburg, in the very crotch of Four Ways.
At what age did you realize, cool, you want to be in the entertainment comedy world? And how did that progress where we are today?
Yeah, for me, it happened pretty young. I got to tell you, I grew up in Vanderbijl Park. I'm not sure I should be mentioning that to any of your listeners. At that point, and back in the kind of late 70s, early 80s, when I was a little spriggot, the Boswell Wilkie Circus used to come through town, quite literally. And I got a chance to see, some of those mad acts. And I remember falling in love with the clowns and knowing almost immediately at like 7 or 8 years old that that's something I wanted to do, make people laugh. So by the time I got to what was then standard 5, I remember sitting down with my folks and asking them, well, not asking them, telling them that I had a plan. I was going to go into acting, and some of the best performances I'd ever seen was the face of my mother and father, bless them, because they offered full support, even though clearly that wasn't part of their plan. But they were amazing in that regard. And the only thing my dad did was to say, well, would you have a backup plan? Because acting is, it seemed to him to be quite a tenuous and you know, high risk industry. He wasn't wrong. And so I did not make him feel better by saying, I'd also like to be a teacher. So he did some more brilliant acting. And that was it. It basically, through all of high school, I knew that I would do those two things. And once I'd moved to Cape Town by then, or we had as a family, and I left kind of high school, went straight to UCT, and I studied a BA performance to enable me to be an actor. Straight afterwards, I did my teacher's diploma, and then I taught for 7 or 8 years, but always in a kind of part-time capacity so that I could on one hand, make some money and have a career, but on the other hand, equally start very slowly, kind of infiltrating the performance world. And that's kind of what happened. Some of this seems planned, but really, when I look back at it, it was incredibly serendipitous. And one of the things that I think was most important is that I learned crowd control. I learned how to hold the attention of audiences. In this case, it was classes of 25 to 35 kids, but that'll be your best learning ground in terms of maintaining concentration and finding, you know, modulation in vocal approach, understanding your own subject so that they can understand it. All of those good things have stood me in good stead, both as an actor, a storyteller, but most importantly, as a stand-up.
Okay, so what subject did you teach at school?
I taught English, drama, and in my first couple of years, a bit of Afrikaans for the youngsters, the grade 8s and 9s.
I'm sure you feel grateful that you taught then and not now when the kids' attention spans are only 15 seconds.
Sir, you won't believe. I've gone back a couple of times. I've still got many friends in the teaching industry, and I've gone back either to do some ad hoc classes or a guest speaker or whatever. And I look at it now, and I'm very grateful. The order of events has played out as it has. I'm now doing the thing that I love. I'm very grateful. And teaching is an extraordinary thing. And the people who do it well, and there are many of them, I have huge, huge respect for. But I'm very happy not to be in that world anymore.
Obviously, your trajectory was teaching and then full-time into the entertainment, comedy, acting world. So when you actually moved into the entertainment, were you full-time successful, or was there any moment of like, okay, I should hang on to the teaching just in case?
No, I think I had a very strong drive and ambition. And in a way, because I think I made some clever decisions early on. I shouldn't maybe give myself that many credit. I thought about things quite carefully. And so while I was teaching, I kind of thought, well, I'm not getting paid a big salary, but it is a salary, and I'm going to start saving some of this. And just those little bits, I think it was 800 to 1,000 bucks a month for those first 3 years, gave me enough money to take my first one-man show to Grahamstown. And that show made 1,000 rand profit. So I used that to launch the next show. And then that managed to – and so because I built small, and I had some amazing mentors around me, both in school as some of the older educators, but people like Mark Banks, the comedian. I remember he always used to say to me, don't get involved with comedy lineups, because that's comedy chorus. People don't remember who the individual comics are in a lineup. Get your own show. Be Allen Committee starring in. You might play to no one, but after 3 or 4 years, people are going to start going, who's Allen Committee? And that's the way you build a little brand and an audience for yourself. And again, as I intimated earlier, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was building an audience through the parents of the kids that I was teaching. And so by the time I left teaching after 8 years of part-time over 3 schools, I had 1,000, 1,500 people who would actually come and watch me fairly regularly. And so from that, you could then fill up a little venue, and that would lead to a bigger venue. You know, when a lot of younger comics turn to me now and they say, how do I start? I'm not sure how you start today. There's so much noise. There's so much happening. You're in competition with things like this, podcasts and vlogcasts and internet streaming sites and YouTube and et cetera, et cetera. And that's besides the fact that you don't have theater spaces like I happen to. You know, that was pure luck that when I started, there was enough space for me to do my theater shows. Mark Lottring and I started in the same month, in the same year, in 1997. And we met up very early, probably in the first 3 or 4 months of our careers. And he was playing at the Baxter. I happened to, Peter Turing came to watch one of my tiny little theater shows. It was a show in which there was only 14 people in the audience, but he was one of them. And he phoned me the next day and said, I like what you do. When you're ready, do another 2 of these shows, come to my theater, and I'll take you between here and Joburg. That was a huge break. Mm. And so that support, I was able to build a career slowly. So to come back to your original question, there wasn't ever a moment where I thought I'm moving too quickly or it's not happening quickly enough. The two career paths kind of ran simultaneously and helped each other. So when it wasn't moving fast enough, you know, in building an audience, I had teaching to help me. Okay. And when the teaching was a little frustrating or inhibiting for me, I was able to then leapfrog into either acting and or stand up.
When you've had those audiences when they were small, 10, 14 people, as you mentioned, when you come off a show during those beginning years or stages of the career, how did you motivate yourself to keep going when there were so few people in the room?
Well, I didn't have any expectations. I mean, I knew I was a nobody. So it wasn't easy in terms of, especially in stand-up, where and my style of stand-up, even from early on, was very much predicated around interactions with an audience. So it's not like I could just turn the house lights down and there were hundreds of people. I knew because the lights were up that they weren't. I was looking at the empty seats. But I also recognize that that's part of the ladder of success. You start down there and you learn this. And I remember meeting Peter Dirk Ace fairly early on in my career and him saying to me, those shows are the ones where you learn, those are the best learning grounds in terms of how to hold an audience. You know, unless there's less people in the audience than there are on stage, you should do the show. It's worth your while.
Yeah.
Well, it's a one-man show. So I was always going to do the show. And I played to one or two. I remember once playing to two people, you know, only once, but it was an incredible, and those shows can be unbelievably worthwhile.
Yes.
Because you ask for the audience's buy-in, and once you've got that, you can do and explore all kinds of exciting things. But yeah, I was very lucky in that in a way, the acceleration happened fast enough for my ambition. Every time I kind of would have gone, oh, I wish it was a bit bigger or better, it somehow did become a little bigger and better. And a couple of things happened. The one was that I started doing corporates, and that was, again, fortuitous if I look back at it. I remember sitting in a Westerford staff room, which is where I was teaching, and a biology teacher that I had a bit of a crush on. I was kind of bragging to her and saying, well, I do this and this. And one of the things I like to describe is physical comedy. And she said, what does that mean? And I was describing that's like a John Cleese or a Lee Evans, a Charlie Chaplin, these physical comedians. And because I'd thrown that term at her, 3 weeks later, she came to me and she said, oh, look at this little ad in the Class ad in the Cape Times. They're looking for a physical comedian. Isn't that what you said you were doing? And I looked at it and it was for a Mr. Bean impersonator when Mr. Bean was huge in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And because of that, and I was much thinner then, I looked a bit like Mr. Bean. Now I look like a Michelin man. But back then, I had to, you know, I got into corporates. I suddenly was doing impersonations. And through that little channel, I started to do some stand-up and MC work. And that led ultimately to facilitation. And all of that has brought me here 26 years later, where the corporate work that I do can fund almost all my other areas of interest and passion, including live theater and actually producing theater. So when I think back to that silly little conversation with a biology teacher that was driven by parts of my anatomy that, you know, she probably wasn't aware of, I got out of that something unbelievable. You know, you can't plan these things in life. That it's an extraordinary thing when you look back and you go, oh, that was a big turning point, but we didn't know it at the time.
You've obviously produced and written a number of different of your own comedy shows. Obviously, one, there was the massive hit that went for a number of years, Defending the Caveman. But now when you move on from that and you're now creating something different and new, do you find yourself thinking or trying to compare to that or thinking that the audience will? Or how do you separate yourself from that to create something new?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I've done 26 solo one-man shows over 26 years. So the task for me, or what's become the task, is to do one brand new show every year. Okay. And that generally happens at the festive season. Peter Turin has given me the Christmas season in Cape Town. And then I, as I've done now, come straight to Monty and play in Joburg. And what that does mean is that every year when I go to the corporates, I can confidently say, well, there's at least a half an hour to 40 minutes of new material that can work in a corporate environment, because the stand-up shows that I'm writing are 90 minutes to 2 hours, but they have sketches and characters, so they don't always translate. But it does mean there's new material all the time. And every time that I sit down to write, I go, how am I going to top the last one? Or how can I say something new? And there are weeks there where I sit and go, I have nothing left to say. I've been doing this now for 20 odd years. There is nothing new to say. But invariably, if you just take a deep breath and start you know, I make notes throughout the year. So one of the things, my process is to open an, it used to be on literal notepads. Now, of course, on our phone, we open the note app and I will be able to make notes of snippets of conversation, memes, thoughts, ideas, chats with people. And all of that builds up over 8 months. And then in about September, October, I sit down and it's at this moment that I panic and go, oh, there's nothing new here. But actually, when I look at it carefully, there's always something new. The world is always offering us, and as comedians, our job is to be, have our receptors ready to see the same things that irritate and frustrate and make us joyful, you and me. A comedian's job is then to step to one side and to see it from a different angle, a different perspective. So, yeah, I think that the answer is there's a pressure to give the audience what they want, but also something slightly different. Sometimes I do go, I wonder if the audience will go with this, but I think what's happened because I do it regularly and because I've built an audience and they've come with me. So many people now have been watching at least 15 to 20 of my shows over the years. And so they have a strong, so I can do things like, and this is a real pleasure. I can do a running gag, which is a, or a recall gag. For those who don't know, that's a gag that in a show, you start with one premise and you can bring back the punchline maybe 20 minutes later, maybe an hour later. Yeah. I'm now in a position where I can do a recall gag over shows. I can do a gag in this show that references something that audiences would have seen 3 years ago. And there's some delight for an audience to go, oh, I know that. I know who that is, or I know what that reference is. So that comes with building a brand and an audience that are loyal and follow. And there's something delightful in that as well.
So I just to let you know, I still write, use a notepad and pen. I don't use my phone. I need to see what I'm writing.
No. Likewise, I do too. To be fair, but what happens is you don't always. If you're in a car, you know, now with the phone, I can dictaphone. You know, I can. But ultimately, at some point, it all gets written down, handwritten, because for me, that's the best way to process it into the brain.
So you mentioned that period of time in September when the panic sets in and you might potentially not have anything to say again. So when that happens, do you actually, you mentioned you take a moment and breathe. What other things do you do in order to get out of that tunnel and then into the light, so to speak?
I mean, the notes help because the notes will often be, whatever I've written down will be a starting point. So I might start Googling, I might go down a rabbit hole. I'm trying to think of a good example, but let's say someone had mentioned cryogenic freezing and how Walt Disney done this. And I thought, I wonder if that's still a thing. Then you go down to Google, what does it cost? Can you still do it? Then an interesting thing came up. Helium is one of the active gases in that freezing process, which came up with a gag. Oh, well, it's funny because if Walt Disney gets unfrozen because of the helium, he's going to talk like Mickey Mouse. So that's a gag that comes out of pure Google. You know, that's just me Googling a fact and going, oh, I would never have known helium was a gas that is part of cryogenic. So that's one way. The other is to have conversations with people and listen to people because everyone is telling you what they're irritated, frustrated, obsessed or preoccupied with, whether it's new TikTok stars, whether it's a new, you know, in Cape Town, a new traffic circle that everyone's irritated by, whether it's the cost of living or President Ramaphosa, whatever it might be, is in the zeitgeist. And if you start listening to people, then you start going, okay, but these are the things that people are talking about, and therefore I must be able to say something about this. And once you've got a ballpark or a ring fence of an area, then it's just a case of doing some hard graft and sitting down and going, okay, you know, to go to a silly topic, state of the nation. What can I say that hasn't been said about the state of the nation? And we go. And sometimes you can sit for an hour and you'll get one silly little gag. And sometimes you can sit for 15 minutes and you can get a 10-minute section that'll be one of the best 10-minute sections you've ever done. And so you don't know, like any writer, you don't know what's going to come out of that session. But sometimes you can write for 2 days and not use a single joke, but those jokes will then sit in a drawer and become a big bit 2 years down the line.
Okay.
So nothing is wasted. All that thinking and writing time is part of a bigger picture. And I always go, I take slips and if I, you know, whatever gags I don't use in last year's show, go straight back into the next year's notes file.
Okay.
Because sometimes I go, oh, actually, now's the time to talk about this. I thought it was last year and I couldn't find the in. Now I know what the in is.
How long does it take you to create So the, for example, Fast and Reasonably Furious, this latest show. So I'm sure it's sort of the same for others, but what's the average period of time from zero sitting to starting to write to the completer? I know you tweak it as you go along and as you're performing, but that the
So,
95%, how long is that?
I would say 3 weeks for me, 3 weeks of fairly intense, every day working 2 hours, 3 hours a day, some days more, some days less, depending how the spirit takes me. Then I've spent a week with my director. And what we do there is he literally sits in my lounge or my kitchen, wherever we're working, and I speak the text out loud, the ideas. And even as I say the jokes or the idea around the joke, sometimes I don't have the joke, but I go, I think this is funny, and I'm trying to work out what's funny about it. For example, we were trying to work out the idea. It's always irritated me. I haven't found the joke to this yet. The idea of people wanting to reverse into their parking bays when they park. Why? It irritates me because they think they're saving time, but they're taking so long to do that that they're wasting any time they've saved. And I still can't work out what the actual joke is, but the idea is funny.
Yes.
So that's one that we spent a long time on, and we came up with two or three scenarios, and I haven't used it in the show, but it's banked because I know
Okay.
there's going to be I'm going to find the joke for that. So then a week with Chris on the floor, and then, as you say, the big learning happens in front of the audience. Once I jump in front of an audience, then we start fine-tuning because, and I like talking about the mathematics of comedy. So not that I'm a big maths man at all, but in any one, let's say half, a 60-minute half, I'm going to have a whole lot of jokes that are let, and I rate all the jokes 1 to 10 in terms of the laughter I'm looking for. So there might be three jokes, and then a four joke, and then a seven joke, and then I work to a nine joke.
Okay.
Because that's how I'm going to build an audience. But actually, in front of an audience, the second three joke is actually a seven joke. It's a much bigger joke than I thought. So I need to shift that because otherwise I get too big a laugh and then the other laughs. Or do I start with a nine joke and then out of the nine joke, I tag on four threes, just little lines that keep the bubble of laughter going. And part of what I do is to work out what rhythm works best for me and the audience in building an hour because it's not a 15-minute slot in a stand-up club where you just want to get as many laughs as you can. Here you're spending an hour and a half to 2 hours with an audience. You're building a relationship with them. And part of that relationship is to take them on a journey where they laugh big, but they're also considering and where they're sitting on what I call a bubble of laughter, where they want to laugh, but they're smiling hard, and then I release them into a laugh. So that's the fun part for me. I really love that. And that exploration continues. Throughout I just played 7 weeks in Cape Town. I'll do another four in Joburg. Every night, last night, we started in Joburg. It's a slightly different format. We don't have an interval in Joburg. And there I have to change the structure of the show. And now I'll spend the next 3 or 4 nights working out how the rhythm alters ever so slightly. So for me, that's the fun part.
So obviously comedians have to read the people and read the energy of the room. So naturally, I'm gathering that teaching helped you with this, but was that something that naturally came to you, or you had to learn it through the teaching and having the shows?
No, I think it's a natural. I think it's you have funny bones. I mean, I don't think there's, I think there is a possibility for people who don't have funny bones to learn principles around comedy and kind of telling jokes and using humor in a work presentation or in a wedding speech or whatever. I think you can follow certain principles, but I think ultimately, when you become a performer, a professional comedian, there's got to be something innate in you. Because that reading and feeling of a rhythm and understanding your own authentic comedy voice, I think that's just in you or it isn't in you. And that is not a bad thing, I don't think, because ultimately that separates those who do it professionally and those who are funny around a braai and who are also delightful and brilliant. But there has to be different because it's too easy for someone to say, I could have done that. My task as a comic is to make it look like you could do it. My task is to make it look like I'm just thinking up on these jokes in the moment, like it's the first time the thoughts occurred to me. My task is to make it feel like it's an easy conversation that's happening in the moment. But of course, it's none of those things. It's a carefully considered, well-rehearsed, mathematically applied, very carefully worked out show. And then it must look like it isn't. Because that's an audience doesn't want to see something that's hard work. They want to see something that looks like it's all just happening. And that's beautiful as well.
How often do you do in inverters, air comments, normal acting, because we do that as well for television and stage.
Yes.
So is it 80% comedy, 20% acting? What is the percentage?
Oh, good question. I think probably 70-30 to comedy. You know, I studied as an actor. I love stage work more than anything else. So even television and radio, when I've had the chance to do it, they're exciting. They're wonderful to do. But my first love is stage and live performance. There is something about the energy between actors, other actors, and the audience that makes it unbelievably unique and powerful. And obviously, stand-up is the most unique form of that. It's one person asking a group of strangers to laugh at them. I mean, it's a ridiculous concept in theory. But I try to, I'd say for the last 10 years or so, once a year, I try to have a straight project or and that can still be a comedy, but it isn't a stand-up show. It's a theater text. And I've been lucky enough, as I said earlier, because of my success in corporates and in stand-up, that I've built up money that I can produce some of the theater shows. It's becoming almost prohibitive now with costs to produce anything too big. But over the last couple of years, I've done a one-man, I've done a Richard III at Maynardville with a cast of 10. I've done Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. These are all great classic texts. One I'm about to do in my 50th year, because I turned 50 this year, is one that I've lived with. Thank you. Is one that I've lived with for ages. It's a production called Amadeus, and it's a brilliant play script. They made the incredible movie in 1984, which won, I think, 10 Academy Awards. And I've known and loved it for so long, and we're getting a chance to do it now in the coming, 5-6 weeks. We'll be on stage at Monty. And it's a brilliant play, and we're using it as we've cut it down to a cost of 8. But it's this amazing story of Salieri, who in history lived at the same time as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, the world-famous composer.
Yeah.
And Salieri, history tells us, in his time, was lauded and recognized as being brilliant. But today, no one knows his music. Mozart, who died a pauper in a lime pit grave, absolutely penniless, is one of the most well-known musicians of all time.
Yeah.
And this play looks at that relationship and says, imagine if Salieri knew that Mozart was the genius and he wasn't. How would that mess with his brain? And what happens to the relationship between them? And it's a brilliant text. It's fantastically funny, but dramatic. And the idea is that Salieri tries to kill Mozart out of jealousy. So, it's a great play to come and watch. And again, to come back to your question, it's a delight for me to then leave stand-up for a short while. Flex other acting muscles, work opposite other performers with great directors, with wonderful text, and have a very different experience. And invariably, once I finish that, I feel I'm ready to come back to stand up again.
Okay, so now when you're acting with other people, whether it's in front of the television or stage, mainly stage, as you mentioned, compared to comedy when it's yourself, do you ever get frustrated of the process of interacting with all those people and that all the dynamics of personalities, or you just accept, okay, now I'm doing this, and when I'm doing stand-up comedy, I'm doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to ring fence it. You have to understand this change in genre. I mean, to add to the complication of this, I love to direct. So I also sit with a director's hat. I also love to produce stuff. In other words, sit back in the logistics chair and the financial chair and try and look at it holistically. And so with all of those hats on, I will sometimes find myself in a rehearsal room and listening to a director thinking, I would have made a different choice, or I would have produced this play differently, or I wish I could interact with an audience because I'd get two big laughs out of this moment and they're not recognizing that they're big laughs. But at some point I have to go, but that's not what I'm doing. I'm not here directing. I'm not here producing, and I'm not here doing a stand-up. What I am doing is I'm serving the story as a character actor or as the lead or whatever it is. So to recognize, I love sports, and I'm always intrigued by the most successful sport teams and the most successful sports people are those who understand absolutely, either instinctively or very clearly, what their role is in the team or what their role is in their sport and how they play. So, this is my strength, because we get lured, as we often do, and this is what happens to Salieri, by ambition and by jealousy of what other people are achieving. When I look at some of the brilliant comics in this country, from Mark Lottring, Skulk Besaidenhout, Dalen Oliver, Tatson Konzo, I could very easily and occasionally will get go, oh, why am I not having the success they are? Why don't I have the crowds they do? My task is to understand, what do I do well?
Okay.
Who's going to like what I do? How can I appeal to my audience and stay in my lane for the most part until I've got enough support that I can then push the envelope or extend the lane a little bit. But to start from the outside and go, I want Mark Lottring's audience, I can promise you that's a fool's errand. It's never going to happen. We are very different creatures. And likewise, as an actor, know what can I do and what can't I do? This is my strength as an actor. I'd love to play, I'd love to play a sexy young Romeo. Have you seen this face? That is not possible. I have to recognize that I am not going to be that anymore. So my task is to always understand what's happening currently. Where am I in my career? What's the project and what does it entail and what does it require from me? Because if you get that answer right, everything feels much easier, or at least possible.
Okay. So Alan, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message to the audience, what would you like to say?
Just, you know, here's my thing. I love where we're at in the world at the moment. There's so many challenges and there's updates, none of them particularly good. But what we do have are these extraordinary people in this country and when I've traveled all around the world. And I think live theater is such a big answer to some of the questions, because there's something quite extraordinary about sitting in a room, whether it's 15 of you or 2,000, and you're watching something and you're having a shared experience.
Yeah.
You might not be having the same reaction to it. You might not all have the same level of interaction with it, but there's something about community and recognizing that in a stand-up show, 400 of us are laughing at the same idea, or in a drama that four of us are being moved in the same way, that brings us together rather than drifts us apart. And my goodness, isn't that something that we could do a little bit more of in 2024 in the world?
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.